Okay, so we're going to learn brachos together first. Yes. Practice, but before that we have to do a quick intro into the Mishnah Gemara. So we started talking about this the other day. This is a history book, Jewish history. It sits in front of us right here. Okay, so this is Masechet Brachot, and you have on the page, you have the Mishnah. You have the Talmud, you have Rashi, and you have Tosos. Okay, so the Mishnah in the whole thing is the oral tradition, written down. So, if you go back, it's very apropos. We just talked about the Jews leaving Egypt. They just crossed the sea in this past week.
Yeah.
Okay, so in the year 1480, before the Common Era, Mount Sinai.
1480.
Before
the
Common. Yeah.
Okay, so
3,400 years ago. Yes.
Was Mount Sinai.
Okay, right. So Moses goes up. We have the Ten Commandments that's coming up. We're going to read about it this coming week,
right.
Parsha.
Right.
Okay. And in that process of, it's not just the Ten Commandments, but at Mount Sinai, and then the process of, you know, what exactly was given then as opposed to over the course of the 40 years in the desert. But the five books of Moses, that, you know, that is Torah, five books of Moses. And then we have expanded other books of the prophets and the writings, the Nevi'im and Ketuvim, Tanakh. Okay. But what Moses got there was a Torah. How exactly, there's different opinions. Is it all given at that moment,
right,
in that time, or over the course of the 40 years, or both, or whatever it is, however you understand that. And then, but in that process of a written Torah, there had to be a corresponding oral tradition to it, because when you take out the Torah and you start reading it,
I know, it makes no sense.
The perfect example is,
what does it mean, put bind them as a sign upon your arms?
Correct.
What the hell does that mean?
Correct. Exactly.
What is that?
Right. So tefillin is the perfect example of, how do you know black? How do you know
the square?
The whole, right? It's not there. It's not there.
It's not intuitive.
It's not even. It's not in the Torah. Right, it's not there. So fine. So there is by definition, there was an oral tradition, and it was made that way, because the truth is that once you put it into this writing, it's really dead. And Torah is supposed to be alive. Mm-hmm. Torah Chayim, it's called. Mm. Living Torah. So the way to do that is you have a text, and then you have corresponding, like parallel to it, is an oral tradition. And every generation, you're going to have teachers and students that are going to work through the written Torah corresponding with an oral tradition to explain it, and to like say, well, this means this means that, right, et cetera, et cetera. Okay?
Yeah.
So now, so based on that, everything is going along. You have this system of, and it's passed along, written Torah with its school, with its.
I get it. It seems to me that it was sort of unbelievable that it could get passed without losing, like, mistakes.
So what's interesting is but before this is even written down, right? You have this type of setup of where it's meant to have this oral, this human component that has to be part of the corresponding type of situation. So they never were going to write it down. It was never supposed to be written down.
I agree, right.
And yes, there's going to be development. Yeah, the point is there will be development. There is a need to develop this thing, right? So there's going to be, and that's part of the whole point, is it's never static.
And aren't there parts that also were not included and then became their writings that got put in when the rabbis were, and then that become a separate.
So with the oral tradition, there had to be people writing stuff down, because there were notes. There was just was no formal. It was never formalized.
Right.
Because to say that Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. So what happens is that you go back after there's the destruction of the temple, and things are getting crazy, and so he understood at that point, you need to start writing formally, write down the oral tradition in this type of format. Mm. But he does it in a way, in the Mishnah, that's very cryptic. It's very, you know, like almost like a note type of thing. Like these are like ways to remember things, but without to really still continue to rely on an oral tradition,
okay,
in a sense, right? So that's the Mishnah. So the Mishnah was written and really formalized in the year 200, Common Era.
So it was 1,400 years of oral tradition.
1480, so it's like, yeah, it's even more than that, right? So we're saying it's almost 1,700 years.
Of oral tradition.
Of straight oral.
Which is like, to me...
It's
almost like impossible how all of this could, and not... Maybe the tefillin are actually supposed to be round.
Okay, no. So that's like, that's already easier. That's harder to like, you know, and they might even have discussions like that. But either way, fine.
Okay.
But you see that there's this, at a certain point you start...
The steak's going to get it, you're going to then be transmitted.
Right, but because it's not like one or two people, because you have masses of people and schools that are doing this.
Okay.
So, if it was just me and you, then, yeah, like,
you know. It's a telephone. By the time it gets to him,
it becomes messy, right? Okay. But if you're going to be in this type of, there are large groups, not large groups, but like schools of, but there is clearly a point in time, and there are, like to your point, when Moshe died, when Moses passed away, they forgot certain laws, okay? But what happened? It says that they were able, through back and forth study, they were able to rediscover those.
Yeah, wow.
So meaning that, and that's really what it's saying, is that there are certain rules that are used, employed, which we'll see in the Gemara, that help you reconnect and rediscover, let's say, potentially lost ideas. Okay? Pretty wild. Okay, so but there's clearly also in the Torah Shabbat Peh, in the oral tradition, there's this need to develop. Right? So you're gonna have certain things that are, you know, this is clear cut, but then there are certain things that have by design certain openness and saying, okay, there's need for development and also ambiguity that will be needed for development of humanity. Humanity is going to develop. Mm. There's going to be something called electricity. Well, how do you take electricity and apply it?
Right.
Well, now I have all these like laws that I can use.
Okay.
Okay. So there's by design there is that openness. Okay. So let's see what happens. So you have the Mishnah in the year 200. That means that till then you have a period of time of what we call the Tanan. So the Tanam are the people of the Mishnah, the rabbis of the Mishnah. And then Rabbi Yehuda Anasi comes and he, like people that you know, famous people from the Mishnah, Rabbi Akiva, you know, this is a name that people know, Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Yehuda. There's Hillel and Shammai. These are people in the Mishnah.
Okay.
Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, you know, you've heard that name, that's the Rabbi Shimon. He's the one that everybody goes up to Meiron on Lag BaOmer. He's the one who supposedly, meaning like the tradition is that he's the one who like got the Zohar thing going. Like when we were in Tzfat, we went to the, okay. But you have those personalities. They're all leading up, and then Rabbi Yehuda Nasi comes at the back end, and he formalizes and writes the Mishnah down. And you see in the Mishnah, you'll have all these different personalities. They're called Tanaim. And then after that, you have a period that starts of the Talmud. So the Talmud really comes along and says, the Mishnah is pretty cryptic. We need to explain, like, what does this mean?
Right.
And so now you have the next stage of development. And you have the Talmudic period, where you have personalities like Rav and Shmuel, Abaye and Rava, where you see something that's called the Zugos. You have the pairs. So you have these two guys, two schools of thought that battle it out. So I saw something beautiful yesterday. This is from a class that Moshe Shapiro gave 25 years ago. And he was talking about the idea of coming out of Egypt, that there were two things that were developed. That Egypt was a backdrop of idol worship. But idol worship in the sense that Pharaoh saw himself as God, that he created the world. And he also saw himself as like controlling the world. I created the world and I actually control it. So comes along the Egyptian experiences that take us away from that thinking of like we're creators of the world. We're not God. But when you think yourself as God, is that you're actually the cause of all reality. You're the center of reality, which we all kind of do anyway, which is something we have to fight against. Okay. But he also said there's this, and that really corresponds to creator of the world is actually corresponds to the written Torah. And then he talks about the idea that there's also this issue of like, that we see ourselves controlling everything that happens. Mm-hmm. We call that the Manig, the one who runs the world, which we're supposed to attribute to God, right? But we see ourselves as running the world. That's our society. It says we really control this thing, right? So that's the Torah Sheval Pat. So he in that description, the oral tradition, and he says there, on that point, he says, if you ever study, and we're going to do this in Talmud, he starts out and there's just confusion. Nothing makes sense. We don't understand anything. There really is a lack of clarity. And then we fight back and forth, question, answer. Maybe it's this. No, it can't be that. It's got to be this.
Right.
No, it's not that. And you go until the end. You go, wow, now I see this. Mm. So the whole process along, he said, that's the same thing as how we can see God's hand in the world. When you go through a process, you experience anything, you're like, I don't see anything. I'm the one who decided to do this, this, and this. It's only when you really like dig in like this process you can see God as the one who's running things.
Sure, sure.
So it was interesting how he developed that here. Okay, so here we're going to have this. So the Talmud comes and starts to really like, and in this, what you see is, we go back constantly to the written, to the five books of Moses and the writings of the prophets.
Yeah.
And it's always coming back to that. We're always going back to that text. You see that that's the process of what's going on here, is always trying to get the understanding of that original
text. The original text.
Yes, and okay. How they play off each other. Okay. And then within that, you'll have everything mixed in here.
So when you're doing this, are you meant to go back and have it
it's almost
with
like,
you, and you're supposed to, like, a reference?
Yes, yes, that, and also almost like it assumes that you know it already.
Okay.
Okay, which is fine. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, which is all good.
Right.
And it doesn't, okay, and then, so now that's, so that's the Talmud, and it Rabina Ravashi are the ones who did, they were the, they, you know, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi was the one who did the Mishnah, comes along Rabina and Ravashi at the end, year 500, Common Era, and they close up the Talmud. They write the Talmud. So there's still nothing on the sides here. This whole press, this is like a, this structure was in, you know, they call this the Vilna Shas. Like years later, when the printing presses came along, they set up these, the way it looks.
Format. Yeah, yeah.
And it became the accepted format, fine. So we have the Talmud. Even in after Ravina and Ravashi closed the Talmud, you see in there, if you look closely, this is for like the real like scholar, we'll see, they'll recognize the fact that there were some people that came afterwards that added in, that called them Savarim, that they, there was a period after that where they were adding, amending the text a little bit to add a little more clarity.
How would they know that?
So go back then. So just in terms of like nomenclature.
Yeah.
So the Gemara is like the actual law. Like make it like the make it square, wrap it, it has this many turns.
Right. There's a lot of what the Talmud is development of understanding of the law. Understanding the text of the Torah, understanding different things in terms of how do we read certain, or I mean a lot of times, how do we understand the Torah in the terms of the written, the five books.
Right.
But and then it also will develop understanding of laws that are also there.
Okay.
And but at the same time, we'll also go off on tangents.
Okay.
Incredible tangents where they call there really two things that they talk about here in the Talmud is the law development and what we call agadata, which is really like Jewish thought, right? So like all of a sudden philosophical ideas and approach to like, how do we look at the world and how do we look at life in the Talmud as well.
Okay. So the Talmud is made up of the Gemara and the...
So the Talmud is the Gemara, okay?
Okay.
And they're interchangeable. Mishnah and Gemara, Mishnah and Talmud.
So Mishnah is actual law itself?
It's also. It's Mishnah is more, usually more structured towards being purely law.
Okay.
There's something called the Agadata, the Agadic, the more the, again, I call it the philosophical thought works, or ideas and thought, Jewish thought, that comes out more in Gemara, slash Talmud, the same thing. They're interchangeable.
And I heard an idea that recently that I had never heard before. That the oral, that there's some people say that the oral law was actually given before the Torah, before the actual written. I mean, not to the. I mean, when Hashem gave it over to Moses, it was oral, and then well, obviously, then it became written. But so that the idea that the oral is way more comprehensive, and that the rest of it is like an abridged version that then obviously has to go out. Anyway,
so. Okay, so it's again.
Let me say it like this.
So if you look at the text, it will say to us that there's opinions that everything was given to Moses and transmitted to Moses at Sinai. Mm. Everything. Mm. Now, is that literal or is that figurative or something in between?
Right.
So it depends on who you ask. What I mean by that is there are people that will say it had to be that everything was literally given over to Moses, like literally down to the last detail.
Just a download.
Yeah. Totally. Complete. Mm-hmm. Or do we say, no, that the key ideas were there and that there's room left open for development or something in between. So I let's just leave it like that.
Okay. Now. Okay. Let's go.
Okay.
Let's go.
Next. So wait, hold on. So that's, we're up to year 500. Okay. Then comes along Rashi, and Rashi, who lived in France,
yes,
in French. He's French. He's born in 1040.
Okay.
So there is some. There's a period in between there called the Gaonim. So this is Savarim and the Gaonim between the year 500 and 1000. There's development going on there. Okay, but things that like the idea here, what we see on our page here, Rashi comes along in the year 1000, let's say, and he starts explaining to us. There's still a lot left open in the Gemara as well. Okay. Rashi's explaining that, okay? He's here. So we're here now. So here this is happening pretty much. The Mishnah is in the land of Israel. The Talmud's happening in Babylon, in Bavel. And then Rashi's in France, 500 years later. Yeah. And he starts opening up and giving us his commentary. And then on the outside here is Tosfot. Tosfot lives... Okay, so they're anywhere from 1100. They're, you know, they say that they're like the grandchildren of Rashi.
Okay.
Okay, but it's not just one guy. It's really Tosfot is a group. It's schools, and they're really located in France and Germany, are the primarily where they are, and they start. And they're going from, let's say, it's a longer period. It could be anywhere from 1100s to 1400s. It's a bigger. Okay. So he's in the 11. Let's say he lived from 1040 to 1105, and Tosfot live. They come like right at the back end of that, okay. But they're two generations after. Yeah. And then okay, fine. And what they're doing is, whereas Rashi's really focused more on the right here on the page.
Yeah,
Tosfot is looking at the full. Writings of the Talmud of the Gemara, Shas, we call it Shisha Sidra Mishnah, the six Sederim, Seders, and they're looking at it from more of a bigger picture, and then they'll ask, well, this is inconsistent because he said this thing. So like they look at things a little more globally. Okay, now I just want to show you like how this develops. Here in the back, you have another kind of like we call them Mishonim. So the people that lived from the year 1000 to like the late 1400s are called the firsts. Rashi, Rambam, Maimonides, these different names you've heard, Tosfos, they're all considered to be Rishonim. We have a hierarchy in terms of where you are, the closer you are to Sinai, the higher authority.
Okay.
As you go further away, kind of like go down, right? So that anything that comes earlier they came, the greater authority they had. That's why you'll see, even in the Gemara, they'll say, there's a guy, he's a Tana. He lived in the time of the Mishnah. A guy who lived in the time of the Gemara, the rabbis of the Gemara, they can't really argue with the guys unless they have another opinion in the Mishnah that they can go with.
Right?
You can't just come out and say, hey, I said, buddy. Who are you relying on for that?
Right. Okay.
So it's like a hierarchy, right? So the Rishonim, Rashi, and the all those commentaries are the firsts. Rishonim, they have a certain authority as opposed to what we call today. This period is called the Achronim, the latter period. It starts with, you went up to Svat, you went to Rav Yosef Cairo. I don't know if you remember that. We went to the Blue Shul.
Yeah.
I remember that. Okay. Yeah,
he wrote the Shulchan Aruch, okay? But I'm going to show you very quickly. I just want you to see like the development. So here we have the Talmud, we have the Gemara, we have Rashi, we have Tosfot. At the same time as Tosfot, you had Rabbeinu Asher, the Rush. Right? The Rush lived in 1270 to 1340. So he's still in that, we call the Rishonim period. And he lived in Spain. Okay? The Rush, lived in 1250 to 1327. He's here. That's over here. So he's in the back of every Talmud.
Oh.
You have the Rush.
It's related to the each.
It's all. It's like literally. You read the Gemara.
And there's that correspondence.
And here he's already commentating. He's giving commentary, and he's kind of pushing towards, looking at this and saying, okay, how do we practice? It's kind of getting us back down to more practical, because you have a lot of opinions here. So how do I get from that, multiple opinions, how do we actually practice? So you start seeing this push to bring it to trying to explain and then getting us towards what we have over here, which is the Rush's son was called the Balaturim. Now the Balaturim, he's taking us to the first real set of halacha, where he's saying, okay, this is what we do. So here we have this Gemara, we have Mishnah Gemara, we have all these guys trying to explain things, comes along the Turim, the Bala Turim, Jacob ben Asher, who's the son of this guy over here, and he starts giving us what becomes the beginning of the Shulchan Aruch, which is the laws of halacha.
Right?
Okay. So here you have him. You see over here, on the sides here,
see. I hope you guys haven't been waiting.
No, we got. come. We're
doing background. So
okay, so we're doing the intro. So you're all good.
You're
now come. We're good.
Yeah, I'm laying in bed and I'm like, oh god.
Let's go. So sit down. Let's go.
So wait, go back in. So let's go.
Wait.
Go to the first Gemara.
Okay.
So there's the Hey, buddy. So where's the first Gemara?
Okay, so how does... Yeah, okay.
So does he...
He go from here. Okay.
Okay,
here.
So this guy here...
Yeah.
Does he have writing that relates to this exact one?
Yes.
So you can't keep it all in one book.
Okay, so how does it... So I'll give you a quick. So we have the Mishnah, Gemara... Year 200, year 500, Rashi's in the year 1000, Tosas 1100s, we flip the back here, 1200s, okay, the Rush, and they're all developing oral tradition to get us to, not that this is the goal, but this is the development, we see that we have, is the Turim, the Bala Turim, which starts giving us the halacha, so what do we do? Tell me what to do, man.
Consolidated answer.
Right? So we start, and guess what? We're not done yet, because even here, you see over here, the size.
Does this relate to that page right there?
This exact one? No.
No, but I'm saying that first Gemara, that first Mishnah.
So that Gemara will be over here.
You can find it in this.
I know exactly where it is, over here.
Okay. Yeah. And it's written right in this form here, like this. Okay.
Yes. So this, right here,
yes,
corresponds to this.
Okay.
Yes. Okay.
And so you have to know when you're reading this, you have to turn to this page.
So I'm going to show you in the Gemara. Yeah. There's a way to see that. Even there's a way to cheat. So the Gemara actually, there are people that wrote this to help you. Hey, I know you're. I'm going
to
help you and tell you where to go. Okay. So now on every Talmud page, when we go through the Gemara, it has notes that say, okay, you want to know the halacha? Here's where it is in the Rambam, because the Rambam lived in 1135.
Okay.
The Rambam really, he's before the Bala Turim by 100 years, okay? The Rambam, studied the whole Talmud, okay? And then said, I'm going to write a book that's going to give you clarity.
Right.
To the point where he said, you don't even have need the Talmud anymore.
Oh,
just
my
use
gosh.
My book and you're good,
okay?
Well, that didn't go over so well.
Right.
You know, it's funny. Today we're like the Rambam.
Yeah,
yeah. They were like burning his books.
Really?
Yeah, it wasn't so simple, right? They really were burning a lot of us in the morning.
Who are you?
But I mean, the Rambam ends up being one of the great. He's like, okay,
no, but other people,
Exactly. They said no because what they were bothered by was you can't take away the whole development here. Here we have the Talmud, we have this. You're going to start, you know, say, hey, this is the development of Jewish law. Mm-hmm. So even on this page, okay, so here's the Bala Turim, 1270. He's in Spain. He's writing this stuff. Comes along now, 200 years later, on this page is the Beis Yosef. The one we went to Rav Yosef Cairo with Blue Shul and Svat. He's sitting there in the 1400s. He's writing a commentary on the Torah. Okay? Not only is he writing a commentary on that, he writes a commentary on the Rambam also. He's in here also. Okay? So then what does he do? But these are, so you see the development here, right? So what do you have? You have this, the Shulchan Aruch. So this is now, we've gone from the Mishnah, Talmud, Rashi, Tosos, the Rambam's at the same time as Tosos, okay? Then you have the Rush that leads us to the Turim, the Bala Turim, who starts really, like he starts seeing getting the codified law. And then in the 1400s, you have this, you have the Shulchan Aruch, you have the Rav Yosef Cairo, who's already been working. You see he's spending a lot of time, he writes the Beis Yosef. His name is Yosef Cairo. The Beis Yosef is the house of Yosef. He writes a commentary on the Arba Turim, which becomes the Shulchan Aruch. And then, of course, it doesn't stop there, because you have on the sides here, you have different commentaries, and everybody is writing on the Shulchan Aruch, on the Beis Yosef's Shulchan Aruch. Then he's a Svardi. There was someone at the same time, the Rama, Rav Moshe Israelis, he's writing an Ashkenazic version. He writes his own book, says, wait a second, we don't need both. They integrate. He integrates his into this. So it's all here. And then, this is the late 1400s, 1500s. Comes along, you have the Chavetz Chaim, who you've heard of, who lived in the late 1800s and then passed away in 1930s something, or 1920s. He wrote, just on, there are four sections, they call the Arba Turim. There are four sections to the Halacha, okay? He took just the first one, which is Or HaChaim, which pertains to our daily life, and he wrote something called the Mishnah Berurah.
Right.
Okay? So you have this, is the Shulchan Aruch in the late 1400s. Comes along someone already in the late 1800s, 1900s, and he's writing a commentary called the Mishnah Berurah on the Shulchan Aruch. Saying, so, and why is this happening? Because life develops, there's development in all these things. And so you have, and there's, it doesn't stop there. There's more even coming out today, where like we met Rav Asher Weiss, right? So Rav Asher Weiss.
We met something.
Okay, you met him also, right? Yeah, perfect. Yeah, right. Exactly. Right. So Rav Asher Weiss, here's this person. He knows
today's technology.
Okay, he knows everything. He knows all the stuff that I just opened up. He knows. I mean, like by heart, it's wild. And then he's coming up with decisions on new questions on all of these things that didn't come up beforehand. But all this is constantly in development.
So it's okay. So to review then, so the original Mishnah, yes, the law of make this fill in square, right?
Yes.
Whatever.
Right, and the black straps and the whole
each
thing.
Each of those little Mishnahs have generations upon generations and generations of commentary about that one Mishnah. Correct?
Correct. And yes.
And the meaning of that, 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 and then they go on to mission number two, and each of those. And so
it's not even that orderly. It's like we call it Talmud Bavli, okay? The Talmud of Bavel, Bavli is Mubal, means it's confusing. It's messy.
Okay.
Because what we just did is we tried to sit down now and say, okay, this is what the structure is.
Right.
But the truth is that by design, Bavel, blah, 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 like things that are not in order, in a sense, leaves us open to develop. So people want to make it nice and neat. The truth is, by design, it shouldn't be.
I get that. Okay. But basically, there's basically a commentary on each of those Mishnahs.
Yes.
And then, so the basic, very basic question is, how many Mishnahs are there?
How many actual Mishnahs are there?
Yeah, is oral laws. These are oral laws.
Yeah, but they're
make it square.
There are
put
thousands.
It this way. Oh, really?
Yeah.
And are there commentary on each of those thousands
yes.
in this kind of pattern of?
Yeah. So even on the Mishnah itself, if I were to study Mishnah, which I do, so when you study Mishnah, there's right. So this is the Mishnah. So like in here, you'll see.
Bigger,
no, I'll show you. I mean, there's different. There is the Rambam has a commentary on the Mishnah. The most popular one is the Rav, the Bar Tanura. He wrote a commentary just on the Mishnah.
Just on the Mishnah.
Yeah. Now, even more recently, so this just came out. This is Art Scroll wrote a new explanation on the Mishnah. It's fantastic.
Mm.
Highly recommend it because it reads nicely in English.
Okay.
It's easy to like just sit down.
And who put that together? I mean, so how do they?
So they have whatever this is basically this Mishnah version of the translation is very similar to the way they did it's called the Schoenstein version.
Right.
For an English speaker, it's fantastic.
Okay.
Because the one that they did earlier, very well done, but very hard to read because it's very, gets lost in the details.
Exactly.
This one said, okay, we're going to keep it as high level. We're not going to get as deeply into it. So we're missing some of that. But for the person who wants to just gather the information, fantastic version.
So there are thousands of Mishnahs.
Yes. Because again,
but there's a first and a thousands.
Like, yeah, so let me explain.
People know what the last one is.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we have it all. It's all written down.
Okay,
it's already done. That's already done.
I'm just trying to get my wrap.
So
that's
yeah.
why I'm
right, so let me show you this. The six we call it Shas. You've heard the word
heard
Shas.
I've heard it. But
Shas stands for Shisha Sidre Mishnah. What that six orders. The six orders of the Mishnah. So it was broken into six sections covering different aspects of life.
Okay.
Zram is to do with like planting, but brachos, the one that we're going to be studying, is in Zram because it's about blessings that you make on things that are planted, right? But even though there's a lot of there, then there's moed, which has to do with time, which would mean Shabbos and holidays.
Okay.
Nashim, women, has to do with marital things related to marriage.
Okay.
So it's like ketubot, Kiddush and marriage.
You mean I could have just read that book and understood woman? Is that what you're saying?
They're extra books. No, it's whatever. Then there's Nezikin. There's the laws of damages, which is basically civil law.
Okay.
Then there's Kachim, which has to do with like the laws pertaining to the work that's done in the temple. So all the sacrifices and things like that. And then the last one is Taharas, which has to do with how to understand the whole idea of spiritual impurity.
Okay. Tahar.
Tahar means to be pure, spiritually pure. That one's like for us is the most foreign because we don't really. A lot of that stuff doesn't really apply today because we don't have a base of mixture of a temple. Even though those laws still pertain, but and actually when you go through those laws. You see, when we, especially, we're going to see in our first thing of the Gemara here today, how those laws still, somehow, they're integrated. Everything's integrated.
So now let me ask one more question.
Yes.
A typical rabbinical student, a guy who's studying yeshiva now, you were, whatever,
right.
Your kid is, right? Do they go through all of these?
These. So they try, but what they're really doing is, but in a classic yeshiva today, they're probably studying Talmud. So they're taking one tractate and they're studying that tractate.
That's a tractate.
This is not. These are stunned. These are like the bigger.
Okay.
And then in there are tractates.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
So underneath this big, like, let's call it the umbrella.
Yeah.
There are tracts. So you have, let's use the one that's most popularly studied in like yeshiva today are Nezikin.
Okay.
The laws of civil laws.
Civil
laws,
okay.
Baba Kama, Baba Metzia, Baba Basra, the gates. The first gate, the middle gate, the last gate. Baba Kama has to do with like your ox gored my ox, and
right.
Those are damaged like that. Or if you left open,
your fence was open, and
yeah, damaged
came and stole
right,
something.
Okay. But Metzia has to do with more possession law.
So typically, Yishuvim will do some of those.
They do. They because those are like what they call have the most intricate. Like
relevance.
No, it's not even relevance. It's more. There's more of the we call it lumdus, which means like analytics that has to go into it, because it's just like there are certain laws that come up that that are very, like, become like, there's this tremendous amount of intellectual.
There's no course of study that takes someone from the beginning of these all the way through all these six.
Your whole life.
Well, some of us are like, when people do Daf Yomi, they're going through the whole Shas. Okay. They're going through the whole thing.
Okay.
But there are people that, when they're younger, kids will like learn Mishnah. Because that gives you a purview of everything.
Okay.
Right?
I get it.
So that's, but the answer is one day at a time.
Okay, now I get it. So I understand the sort of the structure that you just explained. There's no way I can remember, you know, what you just articulated, and I don't know how important that is to understand, like, who's what and which came first and when they were and, you know, like, which is commentating on which. But, you know, for the purposes of whatever you're planning on doing, and I'm not, maybe, I'm sorry, but how, you know, is that written down somewhere where we could, like, see it and sort of refer to it, or is there some way we can...
You want to see
it? Or is it not important?
It's for what we're doing. It's not that important.
Okay.
Because it's just
going outside. I mean, it kind of shows you. You're starting here. You're going out. You know.
But so the reason I gave you this, I'm giving you the background just so I want you to see the big picture.
Yeah, now
we're gonna dive. We're gonna go. This is like a panned out, and now we're panning.
Start at the. I mean, are we looking at the end point, or are we looking in the middle?
We're going from the beginning. We're gonna now start Gemara Talmud. So the way the Gemara works is you start with a Mishnah, which I just wanted you to have the historical background.
Right.
It's the first time that the oral tradition was written down,
mm-hmm.
very cryptic. And then the Talmud, Gemara, opens it up.
Mm-hmm.
And then
but
we're going to see together, what we're going to learn together, what we're going to try to study, is you're going to see, and that's why I gave you this intro, is what mm-hmm. we're going to see is that what they're really doing is they're trying to go back and understand. You have a text in the Torah,
mm-hmm.
which we all are familiar with. No matter, I know we're all familiar with it. It's the Shema.
Mm-hmm.
So if the first oral thing is going to be talking about when do you say Shema at night.
Mm-hmm.
But then what we're going to start when we, and here's what this is what we said earlier. When you go into the Talmud, Gemara, mm-hmm. learning, you'll see that there's just mass confusion. It's by design.
Mm.
It really is like, it doesn't make sense. But then we'll see the brilliance of how it was set, put together, because when we were done trying to get the picture of what they're laying out for us, mm-hmm. and then we'll say, oh, wow. Because right. they're trying to, and then we'll go back to
just in terms of the particular reference points and who's doing what. I mean, I guess you're going to explain
I'm going to explain all
because
that.
Because
I'm going to explain all
I'm
that.
I'm not going to remember different...
Okay, right. So let's go with the first one.
Okay, so let's now we're now after that all that.
Whoa!
Now let's learn some Gemara together. Okay. So, we're going to first. The easiest thing to do is we're going to look at just the word of the Mishnah.
Okay.
Okay. Then stop for a second, take a deep breath, say what are they trying to do here, and then we'll look a little bit of the Gemara today, a little bit of that, and then Gemara is something you read once. And you don't get it. You're not supposed to get it right away. We're going to read a couple of times, or at least, you know, have the basics. Okay. You can read on your own. And then, when we're done with this, we'll say, okay, what's really going on here? I can give you the thread at the beginning, or I can give it to the end. So I'm not going to tell you the punchline yet. Okay? All right. So now, I'm not even looking at the intro. I'm going right to where the Hebrew words are, and then I'm reading the English.
Okay.
From when may we fulfill the obligation? Now, by the way, just when you see it, when it's bolded, that's the actual words being translated.
Okay.
And then when it's not bolded, right, that means it's just like the commentary is adding in his own little, you know, just to help him read better. From when may we fulfill the obligation to recite the Shema in the evenings? Okay. So from what time can you fulfill the obligation to say the Shema at night? So the Gemara says, the Mishnah says, from the time the Kohanim, who were Tameh, may enter to eat their Truma at nightfall. Now, isn't that great? Like, what? What
the hell are you talking about?
Exactly. And the other question is, okay, let me ask you something. Now, don't look outside for a second. So I say to you, okay, guys, when can you fulfill your obligation to say Shema at night?
I would say at night.
Like, well, okay, so how do you define night?
Right.
stars come out, right? That would be the normal way of answer, right? Down, right?
When the Kohanim go in, enter into the sanctuary to eat, or I don't
know. No, so we're saying, meaning, so the fact that they're giving us that kind of answer is like what they're doing here, and the Gemara is going to say, like,
Make me question.
Yeah. No, so the idea is that they're going to actually teach us more than one thing at once.
Okay.
So that's a common thing. Like, here, I'm not going to just... And think about, again, what the Mishnah is going. The Mishnah of Yehuda Nasi is coming along, and he's saying, okay, we have a need to put this stuff in writing because I'm afraid that we're going to lose the tradition. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to put it in. It's going to be cryptic. But in the process of my doing this, I also want to get as much info in as I can. So I'm going to add in, or maybe there's also something going on here we have to figure out. Maybe there's more to the picture than just that as well. Okay. Okay. So now, until when? When can you say the Shema until? And one may recite the Shema until the end of the first watch. Okay. Again, what's that? Okay. These are the words of Rabbi Elazar. Okay. The rabbis, but the sages say it may be recited until midnight. Okay, so that's different. So they're not even, no one's talking about, they've already like basic, it sounds like they're accepting the fact that when can you say it? It seems to be that beginning time, whatever that is. And then now the question is, till when? So the first one is till the first watch. The rabbis, the sages say it's until midnight. And Rabbi Gamliel says, it may be recited until the light of dawn rises. So you have basically, I'm assuming that it's in order. So the first watch is up till X. Midnight and sunrise. Got my three tills.
Mm, yeah.
But the beginning point seems to be kind, universal, at least at this point, that you can say the Shema with the earliest time, or when can you say it? It's when the Kohanim would come in to eat the Truma. Okay? So now, just as, so the, to now, to fill in this blank here, Rashi helps us out. So I'm just going to tell you what Rashi says, even though there might have been the footnote over here. But basically, Rashi says that the Kohanim who became spiritually impure for something, and they went and they to the mikvah, they immersed themselves in the mikvah, but they also required a sunset. So like there are different, a quick explanation of, there are different types of spiritual impurity that someone could incur. For example, the worst is you get exposed to a dead body. So being exposed to a dead body makes you the most tame, the most spiritually impure you can be. But there are other things that you could be exposed to or become tame on a lesser level. So for example, if one sees, has a nocturnal emission, right? If the person has semen, so that creates a certain spiritual impurity. Because what is spiritual impurity based on? It all has to do with life and the absence of.
Mm-hmm.
Any potential for life.
Oh, interesting.
The extreme opposite is creating spiritual impurity. So what's the most opposite of life is death.
Right.
So the most spiritual impure that you could become is exposure to death.
Mm-hmm.
But if anything had potential for life, that's why, for example, the whole idea of a woman becoming spiritually impure for menstruating is because potential for life, mm-hmm. the blood coming out, it shows the opposite of that potential for life. Mm-hmm. So that's why in a monthly cycle, there's some kind of, now this doesn't, the spiritual impurity part of it today is not what we call as applicable, because there's no Beis HaMikdash, there's no temple that we have these issues. Whereas in the past, if a woman is, when she's in that menstruating state, that it would actually make a difference. Let's say, for example, she's menstruating and she starts needing her challah. The challah would be impacted. It would become some type of level of, it would impact this, right?
Sure.
But okay, so today that's different. We don't have that. So there's different things going on with menstruation and things like that in terms of
the mikveh. Doesn't help with regard to make that, to remove that impurity?
It does. It does. Nida goes to the Nida, the menstruating woman, will go later on to the mikveh, which will then reverse that.
Okay.
Okay.
So Tamai means...
Tamai means spiritually impure. Okay.
This doesn't make any sense already.
Okay.
Because this would imply that you can't say the Shema unless the Kohanim are spiritually impure. I mean,
ooh, so maybe there's something about that.
Yeah, I mean, because, and are they always spiritually impure?
Wait, so no. So this is the, so it's a great question. There is, so let's say like this. The letter of the law says, okay, which when I say letter of the law means there's like different levels also. There's the Torah, then there's the rabbinic. Torah prohibitions, highest level, and then, or Torah law, And then there are different levels. So we'll call it the rabbinic.
Yeah, it's like, okay, it's like a law and then a regulation.
Good. So the law, as opposed to regulation. No, which is just, no, it's perfect. It's a good way to relate to this.
But then there were opinion letters.
Which is even lower. Punch holes right through that thing, yeah. Okay, so... But the letter of the law?
Giving you the beginning, from when to when. Good, and the beginning is...
But it's funny the way... So the question is, why would the Mishnah, when it's going to tell us and wants to address, when is the earliest time that one can recite the Shema at night?
The earliest time.
The earliest time.
From when?
From when? And it's using this idea that when the Kohanim... So what's interesting is, in the case of the Kohen who had to reverse his spiritual impurity by going to the mikvah, it was an added a thing that he needed also the sun to set. Harav Shemesh, it's called. Mm-hmm. Now, Harav Shemesh, does that mean that it just the sun sets or that there needs to be nightfall? Are those the same or not? Because if you think about it, now let's just take a step back, right? There's sunset, it's the light out. So from the sun setting, the stars aren't right yet. There's still a period of time before the stars come out. Right. When is it night? When does the day end?
Right.
Oh, okay.
Right.
So when we're now, so when we're getting into
not
this
an interpretation.
Well, no. So when we get into this stuff, we're trying to understand when exactly is all this stuff
having
happening.
To find those things.
So then, so for example, let's talk just for ourselves. When does Shabbos start?
When Chabad says so. Oh,
when they say candlelighting time, what's candlelighting time? Right. What's it based on? You know what it is? It's very simple. It's 18 minutes before sunset. That's what we do.
Mm-hmm.
18 minutes, at least here, it's 18 minutes before sunset. So whatever sunset is, 18 minutes before, candle lighting time. So that's why. And then, so we treat it so that the time that when that sun sets, that's when Shabbos technically begins.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But when does Shabbos end? We don't do from sunset. We wait till at least the stars, or at least a certain period of time from the sunset. That's what gets into this whole like later day thing. Like Rav Moshe Feinstein, who lived this last generation, had an opinion that New York, we wait, I don't know, 40 something minutes after sunset. That's when Shabbos ends. Some say 72 minutes. There's all these different, you know, anywhere from 40 something to 70 something.
What do they do in Alaska where they don't have that?
That's a good question, but let's not go there.
Wait, so let's go back to this though.
Okay, so now.
So when can we say Shema? From the time that the Kohanim who were Tamai may enter to eat there.
Right, so if we could say there's a requirement in that to eat Truma. Ah, so Truma. For them to eat Truma, they had to be on a certain spiritual purity. And they became spiritually impure. They had to go to mikvah. We're going to see what exactly happened there, but they go to mikvah. They go to the mikvah, and then they have to still wait for something called Harav Shemesh when the sun sets or when it becomes nightfall. They have to either wait. It sounds like they're waiting for nightfall. Let's just say it that way. I don't want to be, let's just say. And then the next part of the Mishnah right now is that the three opinions. Till when? Mm-hmm. One says the first watch, whatever that means. We have to figure that out. Mm-hmm. The Gemara is going to talk midnight. About that. Midnight. And then up until, which is what? Alos. So that, what do we say? We call it Achiyel Amura Shachar, which is what? That is not sunrise. It's until it's like light it's dawn. What's called dusk, dawn. Thank you. Right, dawn. We call it Amurashahar. Okay, sun is it, dawn rises as opposed to sunrise, which is something else.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what's going to be interesting also? The Gemara actually, this is like a cool thing. The Gemara discusses it's you know we're talking about like very. You know, when things kind of intersect, when day intersects with night, and when night intersects with day, right? The idea of sunset as the end of the day, as opposed to the stars coming out being night. When does night start? Like all this stuff, right. It's kind of like it's not there's you know, it's kind of ambiguous. There's a certain ambiguity there to that, and also. You know, to the sunrise type of thing. Kind of a practical thing. Let's say my niece just had a baby boy over Shabbos, okay? Well, this is a big deal because when you have a baby born on Shabbos, so when's the bris?
Right.
On Shabbos.
Right. Mm.
So now, let's say that baby was born on Friday afternoon at sunset.
Hmm. Which day is the bris going to be?
So if there is a question, the only time that you can do a bris on Shabbos is when you know that the baby was born on Shabbos, for sure. But let's say the baby was born, we call Ben Ashmashos.
Now we have a question.
When it's like, I don't know, is it day?
My wife.
You don't have to go that way. That already, right? But you see this, like, right? The ambiguity of night, day, practically speaking, gets, you know, so it's fun. Okay, so but here they're already laying us out. Okay, next. Let's continue that story. Now, this is unusual, but the Mishnah actually brings a case study. It says, it once happened that Rabbi Gamliel's sons came home after midnight from a banquet. Meaning they probably were at a wedding, okay? Mm-hmm. At a party. They said to Rabbi Gamliel, we have not yet recited the Shema. And basically we're asking, so what do we do? Can we say it? He said to them, if the light of dawn has not yet risen, you are obligated to recite the Shema. Hmm. Okay? Because he's the one who said it can be said
until dawn.
Right? So he's giving them that. So kind of interesting. And not only that, it says, not only in the case of that the sages said until midnight, when according to biblical law, the time actually extends until dawn, but rather whatever mitzvah the sages said may be performed only until midnight, the time of the mitzvah actually extends until the light of the dawn rises. So there are other cases of where they seem to say up until. So what's an example of that for us? I don't know if you've ever had this where you're at you're at the Seder. Mm-hmm. You say that you're not supposed to have the Afikoman after midnight. Huh. So is that, or maybe that's a unique case that's
a day. That's not applying to my Seder table, but yes.
We're like, getting closer.
Okay, right, but like, whatever. But that might not be that. By the way, that might not actually be a good case of where this would apply that you extend it. But fine. But any time that we'll see why exactly they set it up. If it's really that they uphold that you can actually go later into the night and you can go almost up till dawn. So then, why they say up till midnight? Because they don't want you to mess up. So they know. If they tell you, you can go over until dawn. I'll get to it later. You fall asleep. Oh, man, I missed it. So like they say, midnight's the cutoff because they're trying to prevent you. But okay, fine. So mitzvah, the time of the mitzvah actually extends until the light of dawn rises. In the case of the burning of the sacrificial fats and limbs, the time of the mitzvah extends until the light of dawn rises. And all those sacrifices that may be eaten for only one day, the time of the mitzvah actually extends until the light of the dawn rises. If so, why did the sages say regarding these mitzvahs that they may be performed only until midnight in order to distance a person from sin? Right? So preventative measure.
Yeah.
I'm like, listen, really, I know it's up until dawn, but we know you. So it's until midnight. Okay, I really shouldn't do it. And that's why it sets us up we shouldn't mess up. And we see that in other cases as well. Okay. So let's see Gemara. That was just the Mishnah. Yeah. So that's kind of cryptic. You have three opinions on the back end. Seems to be universal, though, at least. Everybody agrees. The starting time, at least, right now, it seems. Okay. So the Gemara...
Sorry, him is when? Is
Nightfall.
Nightfall.
Well, it didn't really give us... It was kind of... let's try to figure this out. Now, before we even go anywhere, let's just ask this question. How do you know that when the time would be for saying Shema? What do you think it's based on?
You mean the regular type of saying
Shema? Yeah, how do we know when to say Shema at night?
It's probably a ritual you go through. Like you finish your meal. Sundown.
But what do you think it's based on? So this is...
That's what I was asking before. I mean, when are the Kohanim, you know, who were Tamai, entering
the schedule?
So there must have been, the law says that they had this situation where they couldn't eat the truma until they had gone to the mikvah, and that day, so I'll tell you what it is. It must be, again, I'm not 100% sure right now.
At nightfall.
Okay, so, right, but there was the need for two things. They're basically, let's say they're pure and pure for just a day. Mm-hmm. The way it goes is they go to the mikvah first, then they wait for the sun to set nightfall. Now that's, you see what I'm doing there. There's a little bit, it could be one or the other. Let's just say that right now, even though it's probably like nightfall, meaning the stars. And then they're now permitted to eat the truma. But now, I'm asking a different question. Like, how do you think we know that Shema at night should be said at night? Like, how do you know that?
Well, you go back to the Torah.
Good. Where?
It says,
It doesn't say anything in the Mishnah.
Oh, well,
it's not. I'm asking outside. Now this is where I'm here's what happens. So whenever we have any of this stuff, we always go back to the Torah.
Right.
So what's crazy about the Shema is that in the Shema itself, it kind of tells us when we're supposed to say it.
Hmm.
Right? It says,
Hear, O Israel.
Hear, O Israel. You should love God with all your... And then in there it says that you should love what? Let's see the...
Let me pull out of here. It's worth
trying to think of what the actual wording is.
You could spend a lifetime.
Oh my God! I'm one sentence. I'm still stuck on the. You can say it when, from the time the Kohanim may enter.
I mean,
what does that mean? From the time the Kohanim
because.
May enter to eat there.
It's
a rumor.
Right, so that's exactly. We're going to have to. We have to figure that out. It's left. We don't know. I don't know. I mean, they know.
So there must be some law around when Kohanim can say
okay.
that.
Okay, let me I'm going to read this.
Right? Huh? There must be some law as to
when
the Kohanim.
Which seems to be nightfall.
Okay,
and that's
so
right.
That's
right.
One time.
But it's a funny thing, right? Just say it. That's what we're saying. Like, just say it. Yeah. Okay, so fine.
Right.
So now, hear, O Israel, Hashem is our God. Hashem is the one and only.
Right.
You shall love Hashem, your God, with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your resources. And these matters that I command you today shall be upon your heart. You shall teach them thoroughly to your children, and you shall speak of them while you sit in your home, while you walk on the way, when you retire, and when you arise.
Ah.
Bind them.
Is it hand upon your eye? Right?
And then fill in whatever. Right. So in this sentence... When you're in your house, when you travel on the way, when you recline, when you get up. So that in Shema itself, it's talking about when you're supposed to do these things.
When you go to sleep and when you wake up.
Okay, right? So first thing first, what's the Mishnah, the Gemara is going to say? Because the Gemara always says, what's the Mishnah talking about? So it says, the Gemara questions the wording and order of the Mishnah.
Ugh.
To what is the Tana in our Mishnah referring? That he asks, from when may we fulfill the obligation to recite the Shema in the evening? Mm-hmm. The Tana's inquiry concerning the time of reciting the Shema presupposes the existence of an obligation to recite the Shema.
Uh-huh.
Where is this obligation taught? We're starting to the beginning of the oral tradition being written down. The Tana, we're talking the beginning of all of the Torah. Of the oral tradition. So it starts off right away and says, when? When what?
Yeah, right. Yeah,
where's the obligation? It presupposes an obligation. Mm-hmm. Okay, fine. Additionally, and furthermore, why does the Tana teach the law regarding the Shema of the evening first? Let him teach the law regarding the Shema in the morning first. Good question. Why are we talking nighttime? Let's talk daytime.
Mm.
Right? So first of all, how do I know that I even have an obligation? One. Number two, why are we talking nighttime? Let's talk daytime.
Because the day begins.
Okay, so you guys are already...
That hasn't
even been defined yet.
Because you're answering the question, because the Gemara is going to answer your question the way you just answered. Okay, good.
But another question that they ask, but they don't...
So the Gemara says the answer. The Tana is the classic Gemara question. The Tana is the one person from the Mishnah. Right? The person in the Mishnah.
Oh, okay.
Right?
The
Tana,
the
people, any of the people, the characters of a Mishnah are always called Tanaim. Because the Mishnah Tana is the person in the Mishnah.
Okay, fine. So the Tana refers to the verse.
Right. So the Tana refers to the verse in the Torah that teaches the obligation of reciting the Shema twice daily. Because so first things first is that we saw in the Shema, it says, as it's written, and you shall speak of these matters when you lie down and when you arise.
To lie down first is nighttime.
Oh, so that's, you're saying, in the order of way it's written in the Mishnah, in the Torah, I mean.
Yes.
Tells you.
At nighttime and then in the morning.
Right, so therefore, when I'm going to open up and start talking about this stuff, let's talk about nighttime first.
So this is basically giving the definition of a day.
Correct. Well, even though it's not, but at least the way the order of the verse, right?
Yes,
the
verse says, first
reclined, then, okay? And this is what the Mishnah is saying. When is the time for reciting the Shema of lying down? Because it says, when you lie down.
Right.
from the time the Kohanim who were Tameh may enter to eat their Truma. Since the Tana's point of reference is the verse that teaches the obligation to Rosh Chodesh, the Shema, and that verse specifies the obligation first for lying down and then for rising, the Tana does the same. Right? So this is what we were talking about earlier.
They're following the pattern.
But we always go back text. Shema, mm-hmm. We go back into the Torah. We say, what does it say in the Torah? Because that's the basis of all this.
Okay.
It's like, this is the blueprint here. Mm-hmm. We have an oral tradition.
You have the Constitution. Then you've got the laws.
Right? So that's going to be, this is the Constitution, although the Torah Sheba'al Peh, the oral tradition, is a parallel. Mm-hmm. It's almost like they would be in the Constitution example, when they were going through this stuff, they were talking about the
Bill of Rights.
No. They talked about, they have all the back and forth of the people who wrote the Constitution. What do they call those papers?
Oh, the Federalist
Papers. The Federalist Papers, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's the Torah Sheba'al Peh.
Right.
That would be the oral tradition that they saw,
right.
Lahavdil, because this is God.
Yeah, right.
So it's on a higher level, but that's the model, is that we look at the Federalist Papers is the Torah Sheba'al Peh, mm-hmm. of what was written. Although it's really not, because it's like saying the opposite.
Yeah, well, yeah, because the Federalist Papers were written before the Constitution.
Right,
the Constitution
exactly.
was negotiated.
And if anything, right, it would be the opposite. Compromise. It would be because it's like, it would be almost like the Federalist Papers would be like getting into God's mind.
Yeah, well, that
to see why he right. said this.
Right.
Right, okay, but fine. Or at least we have a little bit of a running, okay. The Gemara suggests an alternative source for the Tana's decision to discuss the evening Shema first. Another, okay, by Sema, that's one answer. But I have another answer.
Wait, what's the first answer?
Are you on here?
Yeah, I'm on here.
Yeah.
What was the first answer?
The Gemara suggests.
Yeah, he's reading these.
I kind of like have it. So it says the Gemara suggests.
So lying down.
Keep going right there.
It goes.
The Gemara suggests.
And he's saying it suggests an alternative.
Oh, okay.
Okay, sorry.
What was the first rule?
So the first answer is, it says in the Torah, you recline. And then you get up. So we're going to do it based on what it came first in the verse,
which is evening.
Evening, reclining. When you right. go down,
when you
lie down.
Sleep. Okay,
that's the first answer. Or if you prefer, say the Tana learned this order from the creation of the world, as it says, there was evening and there was morning one day. Mm. Okay, so what's the answers? One
but,
answer
but
is
the same thing. Evening.
It's the same conclusion, but different source.
Uh-huh.
One source is in the Shema, it says when you recline and when you get up.
It's just following that order.
Okay.
Versus the right. God created the world by first it was darkness. And
first there was night,
but
there was day.
But when you lie down, that assumes darkness. So therefore, this is referring to the same thing, aren't they?
Again, we're saying the different sources.
Okay.
Right? One source is saying the Shema, in the Shema, it says when you recline and when you get up.
Okay.
What comes first? When you recline. Right. Therefore, let's start the discussion talking about the evening first.
Okay.
The second answer is, we have a general idea from the creation story that the day follows the night, that the night comes first.
Correct.
Therefore, when I'm going to discuss these things, I'll always discuss the nighttime. The beginning of the day is really at night.
Okay.
Different answer. Different okay. source. The conclusion is the same. Let's right, talk right. about the night comes first.
Okay.
But from where I'm deriving it from are two separate things.
Got it. Okay, keep going.
Now, if that's the case, the Gemara questions the second explanation. Okay, let's read this thing. We see from the order of the creation that the daily cycle begins with the night and ends with the day. Therefore, the Tana first discusses the time of the evening Shema and then discusses the time for the morning Shema.
Okay.
The Gemara questions the second explanation. If that's the case, now here's what the Gemara, this is what he's going to do now. We have the Mishnahs. Remember, the Mishnahs were written, but even the truth is, but he's going to say, wait a second. It says, then in the end of the Mishnah, the Mishnah below, right. the next Mishnah, where it states, in the morning, one recites the two blessings before the Shema and one blessing after it. And then in the evening, one recites two blessings before the Shema and two blessings after it. There too, let the Tana teach the law regarding the Shema in the evening first. Because what happens is, it starts with Shema at night, then it jumps to the morning time, mm-hmm. and then goes into the morning thing, and then it goes back to talking about the night time. So he's asking, I don't get it. Why did you do that? If you're already on the topic of nighttime, stick with the nighttime thing, and then go talk about the morning. We see the opposite happened. It actually starts here with the night, mm-hmm. then it goes into the next question. Okay, here's how it goes. It goes, when do you say Shema at night? Then it says, when you say Shema in the morning, then once it's talking about Shema in the morning, it starts talking about the context. There are how many blessings before and after in the morning? Then it goes back and reverts to, okay, and what about at night? Mm. It should have done night, night, day, day. Okay? So the Gemara answers, the Tana opens the ruling regarding the time of the evening Shema, and then teaches the ruling with regard to the morning Shema in accordance with the cycle of creation. Then, while he's still involved, and was in the morning, he explains the other matters of the morning, namely the number of blessings in conjunction with the Shema, and then explains these matters as they relate to the evening. Okay, so it's just okay. Nothing crazy. Just yeah. Say, I just wanted to understand why are you playing it that way, because it goes: I'm an A, then I go into B, I stick with the B, and then I go back to A. Okay, fine.
I mean, but to that point, you could have done the other one
makes sense, too. Yeah, it could have. Although he's saying once you're discussing, like, when do you? So then when do you do at night? When do you do in the day?
Right.
And then once it's on the day, it starts talking about the day in a little more detail, and then it goes back to, okay, let's address that. Okay, fine. So now, the Gemara now considers the next statement of the Mishnah, which is what was making us crazy. What is this thing about from the time that the Kohanim were Tameh, may they enter, eat the Truma?
Right.
Okay? So now the Gemara asks, "Can you see where we are? I don't know. I laid it out in a very. It's a little bit confusing.
I think
the Gemara asks, right? Michti. Now let us see. When do the Kohanim who were Tamei become permitted to eat the Truma after immersing themselves in the mikvah? So the Gemara answers. So from the time the stars appear in the evening. Ah. So now we finally are defining that.
Of what?
When do the Kohanim have the ability to... When are they allowed to finally start eating?
After they go to the mikvah.
No.
No, when the stars
appear. When the stars appear.
They can go in the mikvah when the stars appear.
Right?
They can go to the mikvah
when... No, they can eat. When can they eat the truma?
From the time that
the stars appear in the evening is when they can eat.
Right. After immersing themselves in the
mikvah. Right, so we're saying it's predicated on that. And then... But it's this. It's again. When can they eat? Assuming that they already went to the mikvah, when the stars come out.
Okay.
So what is the question? We ask this question. Let the Mishnah state explicitly that one may recite the evening Shema from the time the stars appear. Why does the Mishnah state this time in such a roundabout way?
Uh-huh.
Okay. So the Gemara answers. The Tana wishes to teach us something else in passing, namely. When are Kohanim, who are Tameh, permitted to eat Truma from the time the stars appear in the evening? And this is what the Tana means to teach us. That the atonement of offering a Tameh, the Kapar Lamakva, that the atonement offering a Tameh person or spring on the day after his immersion does not hold back the Kohen from becoming Tahor in regard to a Truma. Okay, so background here is that when the guy became Tameh, sometimes... When he became spiritually pure, he had not only the requirement of mikvah, but he also had to bring another sacrifice. So you might think that if he's required to bring a sacrifice, that he has to wait till that sacrifice comes to like kind of make his slate clean so that allows him to be open now to eating the truma. The answer here is no. It's true he still has to bring that sacrifice, but for him to be able to eat the truma, all he needs is for the sunset, mikvah and sunset. The atonement of the sacrifice is not going to hold them back from eating. So now the Mishnah. So in order for us to, so I want to teach you when can you start saying Shema at night. I'm also going to learn something very new. A novel idea is that the Kohen is not prevented from eating his Truma, even though he still has to bring that other sacrifice, whatever the situation is there. Okay, so you see that it's almost like he's saying, I'm teaching you a new thing while I'm teaching you this. And the Gemara cites the spiritual source for this ruling, as it says in the Brisa. Now the Brisa, just as a side, very quickly, a Brisa is the same time period as the Mishnah. There are Braitot and there are Tosefta. There were additional things that were oral traditions from those times that were not put into the Mishnah. They have now. The reason that's important is that they were of the status of Mishnah on a little bit lower level because they weren't, Rabbi Yehuda didn't put it in, but they're from the same time period, which means we talked about the hierarchy here that it will, a Braita, if you have a Braita or a Tosefta that says something, the guy in the Gemara's time, the Talmud, he's already like later, that Braita it has something to it. Right. Even though it's not necessarily become the conventional, you know, part of the system, it's still there.
That's a good point.
And so we use them many times. We'll bring these rites out in to help us clarify ideas. It brings us more information. And it has the same status because of the timing of the historical timing, okay? Cool. As it says in the Brayta, the Torah states regarding a Kohen who became Tamei and immersed himself, and when the sun comes down and the day has passed, thereafter he may eat from the holy foods, from which we learn that the setting of his sun following his immersion holds him back from eating the truma, but his atonement offering that he must bring the next day does not hold him back from eating the truma. He's saying, "Vah Hashemesh." It's all dependent on the day, the sun setting, or the day ending, as opposed to something else, which would be an additional sacrifice, or the sacrifice, right? So they're learning, the fact that it says, "Ubah Hashemesh," and the sun comes down and the day has passed, that's what's the issue. That's the thing, okay? Mm. So now, of course, you can't just stop there, because there's more complexity to that, okay? So let's just see something for a second here. "Ubah Hashemesh v'taher." The pasuk is coming from Leviticus 22:7, okay? So a practice that someone should always do is that whenever you have a sentence, it's worthwhile to always look at it up in inside the text. So we say 22:7. Okay, so this is talking about a case of, what are we talking about? It's talking about the Kohanim. It's talking about them becoming... he became a tzarua. He became a leper. Okay? So he can't eat from the stuff, the holy stuff, until he becomes pure. Or if he becomes impure from... We talked about he has an omission, right? He has a seminal omission, right? Or if he touches something that makes him tamei. So it says, the person who touched this, let's say he touches a dead creepy crawly thing, makes him tamei, gives him some kind of spiritual impurity. He now is tamei, and he can't, but let's talk about the tzara, because a person becomes a leper, there's a whole process, and after he becomes pure, he still has to bring a sacrifice. That would be our case.
Okay.
So here he says... it says here, okay, let me read it for you. The person who touches it shall be contaminated until evening. He shall not eat from the holies unless he has immersed his body in the water, mikvah. After the sun has set, he shall become purified. Thereafter, he may eat from the holies, for it is his food. But what we see there is that it's about the day ending. It's the day ending, now he can eat. Uva Hashemesh. Okay, so the Gemara questions the Brisa's understanding of the verse. And on what basis do you conclude that the expression, "and when the sun comes," means the setting of the sun, and this expression of "v'taher" means that the complete passing of the day? What does "v'taher" mean? "V'taher" means actually, it means to become pure. So, but why are you learning that the "taher" means passing the day, from which you derive that the Kohen may eat the truma even before the bringing of his atonement offering? So perhaps you can understand. We're explaining it, the verse. We're looking now at the verse. And we're saying, you understood the verse to mean that the sun came, the sun comes, meaning it's set, and v'taher means the end of the day. But I would understand it, actually, maybe it's you can understand it differently. That, like I said, it means that you became pure. Nothing about the day. Perhaps the expression, "when the sun comes," means the coming of the light. When the sun, maybe it means something different. Maybe it means the sunrise. Because Uva Hashemesh, think about this, okay? The sun came.
Right.
What does that mean?
Yeah.
Could mean sunset, and sunrise. Okay, so the ambiguity there. And then the Taher, why we thought that means the end. We explained it as the end of the day. I just said, no, it means that he became pure. Maybe it means that the person should make himself tahor by offering his sacrifice. Thus, the verse would be teaching that the Kohen may eat the truma only after he offers his atonement offering in the morning.
Right.
Okay? So the Mar answers, Rabba Barav Shila said, if that's the case, if so, that the verse is instructing the Kohen to bring the offering in order to be allowed to eat the truma, let the verse say, what should it say? V'yitaher. It says v'taher. Mm-hmm. It became pure. V'yitaher is, and he will. The yud, extra yud means it.
Right.
In the command.
You should have said, if you're saying it, you have to wait for the sacrifice.
You'll have to, it sounds like you have to do something. Right?
It would have worded differently.
So since the verse does not use this form, what then is the meaning of the word vitaher? It must mean the passing of the day, like people say, the sun has set and the day has passed. So, but you see in the verse that there's like, so they, like they're focusing in, and they're like, you see how critically they're reading the verse. Mm-hmm. And so therefore they're saying that. So it all starts. So we're take a step back. Now we look back at the Mishnah. The Mishnah started and said, when do you say Shema at night? When's the first time you can say it? Oh, it's when the Kohen is able to eat his Truma. It's like, okay, it's like, but what? And then we like said, okay, well, it's teaching us two things at the same time. So, whoa, no, it's even deeper than that. What it's really saying is, I read this verse, I would have thought multiple things. But if I really read it critically, what I come out from this is that what it's teaching us is that it must be talking about the end of the day, when the day ends, and that's what allows the guy to be able to eat the truma without any necessity. He doesn't need to bring a sacrifice, no extra atonement to be able to at least be allowed to eat. Because I'm reading this word, vitaher, and he became pure. Vitaher is no, it means that the day ended. And that caused him to become pure. Because of something, nothing that he did.
Oh.
It's that, you hear what it's saying? It's saying, the day ends and you became pure. You didn't do anything. It's just the day ending made you pure.
Oh, wait, so what does it say here? It says, from the time the Kohanim may eat
the truma, now I learned something new. That first, how I read that text, Vitahara tells me he didn't do anything. It's the day ending. The day came, the day went, and you became pure without doing absolutely anything additional. Because it's the ending of the day that made you pure to eat the truma. Vitahara. So from the fact that it said it, not Vitahara, that you'll do something to become pure. No, you became pure just by being what? Because the day ended. So you see from this, right? So that's the Mishnah, right? You see that he's giving you this incredible deep, you know.
If I have to, otherwise the people in my shul will be.
No problem.
Yeah. How far are you going
to
go?
We'll stop here.
Wow.
I mean,
what's amazing is that it's kind of,